up protein synthesis, which will probably take most of the class. And there's a little too much echo, so I'm going to move the... I've turned it down a little bit. So last time, we went over the mechanics of protein synthesis using both a model and a handout. And by the way, we have made a demo, a video of the demo, which hopefully will be posted shortly. So where is the ribosome in all of this? So what I've drawn up here, and what I want to look at first, is just steps 4, 5, and 6. I want to put in the ribosome, and then I want to talk about the features of the ribosome that we didn't get to last time. Then we're going to fill in the features of tRNA we didn't fill in last time, and then we're going to summarize the whole thing. So here we have a tRNA with two amino acids, the growing peptide chain, and the next tRNA with just an amino acid. So the ribosome would be here. I didn't put in quite enough. Well, we should have one more white mark here because there are two codons. So the ribosome then has in its P site the tRNA with a peptide, in its A site the tRNA with an amino acid, and the last tRNA, which gave away its amino acid, has left the E site and is going to be recharged. So now what has to happen next is that we're going to make a peptide bond. So the peptide bond, you may remember, goes from the peptide to the amino acid. So we're going to make a peptide bond where the arrow is, joining the peptide to the amino acid. So in the next picture, the ribosome and the message are still in the same relative place, but an empty tRNA is in the so-called P site. Nothing is in the E site, and the A site has a tRNA with a peptide on it. Now, this, nothing fits, so this is the signal for everything to move one codon. Now, in this picture, we're going to move the ribosome further down toward the 3' end. But what probably really happens is that the message, the ribosome stays put, and the message is pulled one codon toward the 5', but the net result is the same, that the ribosome moves one unit relative to the message plus tRNA. So now the tRNA with the peptide is in the P site where it belongs. The empty tRNA is in the E site where it belongs. And the A site is empty, ready for the next tRNA with an amino acid. So all I have done is to superimpose this ribosome on your handout. It's exactly the same as the handout. Now, according to this picture then, you have a messenger RNA. The two halves of the ribosome come together near the 5' end and form a working ribosome. tRNA is attached to that ribosome, and the growing chain protrudes from the ribosome. Now, the way we drew the showed the model and the way we drew it last time, the ribosome moves relative to the message down to the end, and the chain on the ribosome gets longer and longer and longer. But you don't really have one ribosome on a messenger RNA. The messenger RNA is actually covered with ribosomes. So what happens is as the ribosome moves down further, that clears up some space for a second ribosome to attach. So this is ribosome 1. And now a second ribosome can attach. And both of them continue down the message using tRNA, making a growing chain. Now, what will happen is that eventually the message will be virtually entirely covered with ribosomes. And this is called a polyribosome, or a polysome for short. Now, Now, what happens is when the very first ribosome gets to the final stop codon, then it's going to release its chain, release its transfer RNAs, come apart into subunits, which then can be reused. So these subunits join the pool of subunits, and every time you need to add a new ribosome, a pair of subunits clamps on to the beginning, becomes a ribosome, and moves down. Now, in this picture, the ribosome moves down. But I could have drawn it the other way. So it's easier to see the alignment this way. But what would be the other way? If it's really the message that's moving, what would the second picture look like? I would have to pull the message that way. So instead of moving the ribosome down the message, I would pull the message through the ribosome, and the picture would look more like this. But it doesn't matter whether I move the ribosome or the message. In any case, I clear up an area on the 5' end for the next ribosome to attach to, and that's the point. So as each ribosome moves down, a new one can attach until the whole thing is covered with ribosomes. And they're continually adding at one end and falling off the other until that message has been translated enough. Now, there are two other things about ribosomes that we have to talk about. And the next one is the actual structure. What is a ribosome? What is it made of? How is it put together? And for that also, you have to go back to 13A, and look at the bottom. Now, what we've drawn here a working ribosome consists of two pieces clamped together. And so I've drawn it like this. One piece is bigger than the other, which is why it's represented this way. Now, this is a ribosome. A ribosome, as we mentioned last time, is a complicated machine. It's not just made of protein. It's not just made of RNA. It has parts of each. And so it's called a ribonucleoprotein or a ribonucleoprotein particle. And since nobody wants to pronounce that, it's called an RNP. For the RNA part and the protein part. Ribosomes are very large. The ribosome has a molecular weight of several million. A very large protein is a tenth of that. So this is a very big, complicated thing. When ribosomes were first discovered, there was no way to get their real molecular weight. All you could get was their S value in a centrifuge. That is, by sedimentation velocity, how fast do they move down the tube? And so ribosomes are known by their S values. Now, the ribosomes are very similar in eukaryotes and prokaryotes, but everything is smaller and simpler in prokaryotes. So there are two numbers for everything on your handout. The smaller number is for prokaryotes, and the larger number is for eukaryotes. So the ribosome is either 70S in a prokaryote or 80S in a eukaryote. And this corresponds, as we said, to a molecular weight of several million. Now, when ribosomes are not working, they come apart into their two subunits, each of which is an RNP. Each part contains both RNA and protein, and they are known, not surprisingly, as the small subunit and the large subunit. And they're also known by their S values. The large subunit is 50 to 60S. The small is 30 to 40. Now, the small subunit is still at least a million in molecular weight, and the large subunit is more. So we're still talking very big things. Now, each subunit is assembled inside the cell from at least one RNA and many proteins. So that's the next step here. If you take it apart, the small subunit has one RNA in it, and this is 16 or 18S, depending on whether it's a eukaryote or a prokaryote, and it has has somewhere approximately 20 to 30 different proteins. The exact numbers are written on your handout. So this is a complicated thing. Even the small subunit is complicated, and it has many, many parts. Now, this RNA is much bigger than transfer RNA. Transfer RNA is only about 75 nucleotides. This is in the thousands. So this is pretty big. Now, this is what's in a small subunit. What's in a big subunit is similar in that you have one large RNA, which is called 23 or 28S, depending on eukaryote, prokaryote. And then you have, instead of 20 to 30 proteins, you have 30 to 40 plus. This is different proteins. Now, each subunit, then, has one relatively large RNA in the thousands of bases. But it has, the large subunit has additional small RNAs. Now, they're a little bit bigger than tRNA, and they're like 100, 150. But they're relatively small. All ribosomes have what is called 5S RNA. And eukaryote ribosomes have one additional one, which is 5S. This is eukaryotes only. Now, to make a ribosome, then, you need the RNA in the small subunit, the big RNA in the large subunit, and one to two smaller RNAs in the small sub in the large subunit. All these RNAs collectively are known as ribosomal RNA, or rRNA. So to make a ribosome, you have to make all these RNAs and all the proteins and put it all together. Now, one of the interesting questions is, in a cell, where is the information to put this all together? Where is the information to fold a protein properly? It's in the amino acid sequence, or the primary sequence of the protein itself. So the question is the information here embedded in the primary sequence of the RNA and the protein, or is there additional information needed? Well, it appears that all the information you need is embedded in the primary sequence. And the reason we know that is you can reconstitute ribosomal subunits from prokaryotes in vitro, in a test tube. An extremely patient and careful investigator isolated all the ribosomal proteins of the small subunit, isolated the RNA of the small subunit, put them together in a test tube in the right order, and got a working 30S subunit. He also was able to reassemble from its parts, each purified, a 50S ribosome, put these two ribosomal halves together, and get them to translate message and make protein. So you can mix all the parts. Now, this means that ribosomes, just like proteins, self-assemble. That is, when you mix the parts together, they rearrange till they reach the lowest energy state, and that is stable and is maintained. So things more complicated than a single macromolecule can fold and self-assemble. Things as complicated as a ribosomal subunit can do that. Now, there is one other piece of ribosomology that you should know. If we come back to our protein synthesis picture of how the chain grows, you see, as we emphasized last time, that you add the peptide to the amino acid, not the amino acid to the peptide. And therefore, the catalyst for this reaction is called peptidyl synthetase. Once you line up a chain and an amino acid, linking the two end amino acids is catalyzed by this, I hesitate to call it an enzyme, because it turns out that although this is part of the ribosome, the peptidyl synthetase activity is part of the ribosome, but it resides in the RNA part and not in the protein part. So the catalytic, this is the first case we've met of a catalyst which is not made of protein, but is made of RNA. And a catalyst that's made of RNA is not called an enzyme. It is called a ribosome. We now know of other catalytic RNAs, most of which are part of ribonucleoproteins. But in those cases, it's often, sometimes at least, the RNA and not the protein which has catalytic activity. Now, these catalytic RNAs are thought to be, so to speak, leftovers from very early organisms in which RNA did most, if not all, of the catalytic activity. Over time, proteins have taken over most catalytic activities, but a few ancient and important ones still reside in the RNA, and this is one of them. Now, this is all I want to say about ribosomes. There are many other interesting things about them, but I want to leave ribosomes per se for now, unless if you're more interested in the structure, there is more in your textbooks and online. Now, I have stop here first. Are there any questions about the ribosome here before we go on?
Just each ribosome in the polyribosome is making a separate protein, is making a new copy of the protein.
His question is each of these making a protein? Yes. Each of these ribosomes is doing the routine we wrote over there. So each ribosome, it has an E site, a P site, and an A site, is binding two loaded tRNAs at a time and making peptide bonds. So if we drew this right, there would be a chain coming off here, and a chain off here, and a chain off here, and a chain off there. Peptide chain. Yes?
How close can they be?
How close can they be? I don't know the exact answer, although it is well known. Remember that ribosomes are quite large, so that this is covering not two codons worth, but much more. Now, there is a question that I want to discuss next, which arises out of the structure of ribosomes, but is a related matter. And this is the question of how does protein synthesis get started, and how does it end? The starting and stopping of DNA replication works differently than the starting and stopping of transcription, which works differently than the starting and stopping of translation. So now we're looking at translation. Now, maybe the easiest way to do this is to look at this picture here, which is what you have on 13B. It's the very first step in protein synthesis. But the picture on your handout has no ribosome. So let's add the ribosome. And see what this adds to the picture. I would have bought my little paper ribosome, but I was afraid of getting it wet. I don't have a replacement. So, is this picture okay? Here we have an A site. What is supposed to go in an A site? A tRNA with a single amino acid. No problem. What about here? What is supposed to go in a P site? A tRNA with a peptide. Do you see a tRNA with a peptide? No. So the question is, how does this ever get started? And the answer is, an ordinary tRNA with one amino acid does not fit here in the peptide position. But you may remember that all protein synthesis starts using the codon AUG, which codes for methionine. And the reason it works that way is there is a special tRNA for methionine, and that special tRNA only fits in the P site. So that tRNA is called the initiator tRNA. It's a tRNA for methionine, but it's the initiator. So we add the I. So that tRNA has a slightly different shape than the others, and it will fit in the P side of the ribosome. So that means when we get started, the start codon is always AUG. This is always the amino acid methionine. And it's the tRNA initiator, the initiator tRNA. If that's true, if you look at your proteins, do they all start with methionine? You want to bet? The answer is no. If you look at the proteins of an organism, they don't all start with methionine. And the reason for this is a phenomenon which is usually called processing. After you make many molecules, both small and macromolecules, often an enzyme comes along and does a few modifications. In the case of proteins, after the protein is made, an enzyme often comes along and cuts off a few amino acids. So the protein doesn't start with methionine. Now, processing is extensive, and as we'll see next semester, it's much more extensive in eukaryotes. So because of after the fact, after the synthesis processing, most proteins do not start with methionine. The argument here is that for manufacturing purposes, it is more efficient to start all proteins with methionine and take off the methionine afterwards if you don't want it, than to have a special starting system for each amino acid. So that's the rationale. Now, if what I said is true, suppose we're chugging along, and this codon is AUG. After all, methionine is found in the middle of proteins, but AUG is the only codon for methionine. So if we're going to put a methionine in the middle, we have to have AUG here. Now, can this tRNA work under these circumstances? What is special about this tRNA? Does it fit in the A? No. What's special is it fits in the P site. But here we have an empty A, and we need a tRNA carrying methionine. So there have to be two tRNAs that carry methionine. One that is the special initiator tRNA that goes in the P site only, and one is just a regular, ordinary, garden variety tRNA. So we also have regular methionine tRNA, and it's usually just written tRNA meth. So cells have both kinds of tRNA. Both tRNAs recognize the same anticodon. Both tRNAs are loaded with methionine by the appropriate enzyme. But something about the middle of those tRNAs is different, so that one folded up fits in the P and the other folded up fits in the A. Now, that may solve the start problem. What about the stop problem? Here we have a tRNA with a growing chain. And now the ribosome, but here the next codon is a stop codon. It's UAA or one of the three stop codons. So here is our ribosome. What is going to happen? And the empty tRNA is probably still here. Why do we have to stop? Why can't we keep going? There is no tRNA for stop. There is no tRNA whose anticodon matches any of the stop codons. So there's no tRNA that can fit in here. So that means you can't skip, so you can't add another amino acid. There is, however, a protein which fits in here in the A site where the stop codon is, which is called a releasing factor. This protein is responsible for releasing the peptide chain from the last tRNA, and thereby ending protein synthesis. So once the chain is released, this ribosome will come apart into its subunits, the tRNAs will go and get recycled, and the other ribosomes will move down the message and do the same thing. So there's a special start tRNA, but there is no special stop tRNA. Are there any questions about this start-stop business? Yes?
Can the AUG in the middle of a protein also act as a start for
another? Can the AUG in the middle of a protein also act as a start for another protein? In some special cases, yes, but normally, no.
So how
do you know which is the right AUG to start at? It's a little different in eukaryotes and prokaryotes. And eukaryotes is just the first one. In prokaryotes, I think it's determined by the surrounding sequence. Ribosomes will only attach at certain positions. So they won't attach in the middle. They'll only attach at what ought to be the end. All right, now that pretty much covers anything involving ribosomes, start, stops, and chain growth. But there is one other thing, whole area, we haven't really discussed. When we did our models of protein synthesis, we assumed that each tRNA had the right amino acid on it, and that we had the energy to drive protein synthesis. Now, what we want to consider now is how does the tRNA get the right amino acid on it? And we've implied that breaking this bond between the amino acid and the tRNA provides the energy to drive protein synthesis. So I want to talk about those two parts. It turns out that the loading of tRNA, getting the right amino acid on, is a very complicated business. But the reason it's so important is ultimately it both provides the energy to drive protein synthesis and the accuracy. So for this part, what we want to look at is the handout for today. You want to look at 14B. Consider what could happen here. Suppose we have an amino acid and a chain, and we want to add the amino acid to the end of the chain. So I've just written the obvious thing here. You take the amino acid and the chain, which is, say, n amino acids long, and you add on one amino acid, and you get a chain n plus one amino acids long. That, it turns out, is an uphill reaction. That is, it has a positive delta G, and it won't work. Instead, the amino acid and the chain have to be attached to tRNAs. So we've drawn that up here. And we've drawn this bond as a squiggle because it's a high-energy bond, meaning that when it's hydrolyzed, you get a large negative delta G. So the amino acid is attached to a tRNA. The chain is attached to a tRNA. And now, when I make a longer chain, that too is attached to a tRNA. So one of these connections is broken, thereby providing the energy needed to add the amino acid onto the chain. And that's a downhill reaction. The energy you get from breaking the amino acyl tRNA connection is sufficient to provide the energy to make a peptide bond. Now, it turns out that protein synthesis requires an additional input of energy because for the ribosome to move relative to the message requires even more energy. But we're ignoring that part. We're just going to look at this part. Now, this may look very familiar. When we talked about how nucleotides are made, I drew a similar picture, in that just adding on one was uphill. But adding on and breaking some important bonds was downhill. And this is the same deal. And as before, it's going to take ATP to get us from the bottom to the top of the hill. But before we do the ATP part, I want to look at an actual sequence of amino acids, which I think will make this clearer. Let's suppose the chain is metgly-ala. I picked this particular example because this is the one that is in your notes written out. There's a diagram in your notes with exactly this example. But I don't think you need it for this argument. I think it's easier to stick to this handout. And suppose the amino acid is HIS. Now, from everything we've said before, if you were to add this amino acid to the chain, which end would you add it to? Which way do chains grow? Lucky to us, the way we write them. So this is the amino end, this is the carboxyl end, and I would actually add HIS to the carboxyl end. More properly, of course, we know you add the chain onto the HIS. But the net effect would be to get metgly-ala-HIS. So however we do it, that's what we're going to end up with. So now let's look at the tRNA situation. We would have to have histidine then attached to tRNA. And our chain then would be metgly-ala. Which end is attached to the tRNA? It's going to be the ala. It's always the carboxyl end. So it's going to be, I'm going to have to write it up here, I think. I knew it. Oh, well. Metgly-ala. Okay. Now, this is the easy question. Which tRNA is this? The tRNA for? This is meant to be obvious. Yes. But what tRNA is this one? It's going to be ala, because we've added on to the last one. Okay. And now, when we actually make the peptide bond, which of these are we going to break? In other words, which tRNAs are these? So what's this one? This is going to be actually the ala one. Because remember, we're going to break the connection of the peptide to the tRNA and add the peptide to the amino acid. Peptidyl synthetase, or in fact, peptidyl transferase. So we're going to end up releasing tRNA ala, and our chain's going to end up in tRNA HIS. And if this wasn't obvious to you, it's worth rerunning it at home until it is obvious. Okay. So in order for this to work, we have to get the amino acid on the tRNA. And previously, we had to, in its due time, get each of the other amino acids on their tRNA. But we're going to focus just on the histidine. How did we get the histidine on the tRNA? So if you look at your handout, you see that there's another part to it. Not to anyone's, I hope, great surprise, we blew some ATP in order to get the amino acid attached to its tRNA. So we had to input a tRNA, and we had to input some ATP. Now, we are going to make a high-energy bond. If we break a high-energy bond and make a high-energy bond, what's the approximate delta G0 change? Zilch. So in fact, to drive this in the right direction, we have to break two high-energy bonds. Same trick as when we made nucleotides. Now, with nucleotides, we knock two phosphates off one ATP. off two separate, excuse me, we knocked one ATP off two separate ATPs to get what we wanted. Here, we knocked two phosphates off the same ATP. So you notice your picture. Instead of getting ADP, adenosine diphosphate, we get AMP, adenosine monophosphate, and we release two inorganic phosphates. But however we did it, we've broken two high energy bonds to make one. Okay. So what did we do here? We combined two reactions. And these are reactions one and two on your handout. The first reaction is we just took tRNA and we took an amino acid and we put the amino acid on the tRNA. And of course, you need water if you want to balance it. On the other hand, we took ATP, and again, you need water. It turns out that you don't break it down directly to AMP and two inorganic phosphate. You break it down to AMP and pyrophosphate. What is the delta G for reaction two? More or less. I hear a negative 7. What's the one for reaction 1? No high energy bond, high energy bond. More or less, plus 7. Well, we just broke even. We're not ahead at all. But do we know what to do with this? This is pyrophosphate. Pyrophosphatase is ubiquitous in the cell. So it doesn't matter where the pyrophosphate came from, whether it came from polynucleotide synthesis or whether it came from loading tRNA. This pyrophosphate is dead in the water. So if we can get reaction 1 and 2 coupled, reaction 3 will take care of itself. And the point of reaction 3 here is that it removes the pyrophosphate, driving the second reaction to the right. Or, if you add all 3 together, it's minus 7. So, same argument we made for polynucleotides as to why you need pyrophosphatase. Yes?
Is there a reason you go from ATP to AMP and then the polynucleotides?
So the question is, why do you go to AMP here and ADP in polynucleotides? Well, the real answer is that's the way it is. We don't really know. It's assumed to have some evolutionary answer, that it has to do with the accidents of what enzymes were able to do and then got refined. But the real answer is nobody knows. So coming back to this then, now there is a possible explanation of why we have AMP. And that has to do with the fact, now that I think about it, that in order for these things to work, you have to make a high-energy intermediate. You have to connect some part of the ATP to the thing you're trying to juice up. And AMP, it turns out, can be connected to an amino acid probably more readily than ADP. Now, you may not understand what I'm talking about, but I'll explain it in a second. All I have done here is to announce that these two reactions shall be coupled and take place at the same time, and we're in gravy. But as with our previous example, it's not enough to pour gas on the floor and light it in order to get it to drive something else. You have to have some connection between these two. So the actual way the reactions are coupled, one and two, is A and B, which are also written on your handout. So let's look at A and B. Reactions A and B take place together sequentially on the surface of a single enzyme. If we're talking about histidine and histidyl tRNA, there's one enzyme for that. If we're talking about leucine and leucyl tRNA, there's one enzyme for that. But for our particular amino acid, whatever it happens to be, there is an enzyme. And on the surface of that enzyme, this is reaction A. ATP is split into AMP and pyrophosphate, and the AMP is attached to the amino acid. And the pyrophosphate is released. Now, we know what happens to pyrophosphate. ZAPO. So the product here is removed, so this reaction is irreversible. However, reaction B, on the surface of the same enzyme, AMP plus the appropriate amino acid, they're connected by a high energy bond. The amino acid now is going to be passed off to tRNA, and the AMP is going to be released. So we have the cognate tRNA, and we end up with amino acyl tRNA, which is why we bothered to do all of this, and AMP. Now, the net result of these two is the same as the net result of these two. And you throw in pyrophosphate, you get this arrow. The A and B, or 1 and 2, give you pyrophosphate here. To get to 2 inorganic phosphate, you have to add pyrophosphatase. Now, there is an argument that having the amino acid put on the tRNA in two steps actually has an advantage. That this means that the amino acid and the tRNA are essentially checked twice by the enzyme. The amino acid has to match the right enzyme, and then the tRNA and the amino acid AMP have to match also. So this is like the argument for proofreading. If you check twice, the accuracy is increased. Because if you made a mistake the first time, you can back up. If this is the wrong amino acid, this bond can be hydrolyzed, and the cell can start again. So in both the making of nucleotides and the loading of tRNA, you have that principle of measure twice, cut once. And this is thought to increase the accuracy. Remember, we said that in order for protein synthesis to work right, you have to get the right amino acid on the right tRNA, or you're in big trouble. And this method, this reaction, this combination of two steps, which ends up with ATP plus amino acid plus tRNA. This is what's written sum A plus B on the bottom, next to the very bottom. You get loaded amino tRNA plus AMP plus pyrophosphate. And if you throw in pyrophosphatase, you get the master super reaction at the bottom. That this has a higher accuracy of matching up amino acids and tRNA than a normal one-step reaction would. Now, the enzymes that match the amino acid with the corresponding tRNA, there are at least 20 different ones, for histidine, histidyl tRNA, leucine, leucyl tRNA, etc. Those enzymes have at least 3 different names. And it's worth knowing that because the 3 different names emphasize the 3 different functions of this charging business. Charging up or loading the amino acid. These are called loading enzymes. They're called charging or activating enzymes. And they're also called amino acyl tRNA synthase or synthetases. Now, what is this enzyme, the catalyst by this enzyme, achieve? You get the right tRNA, you get the tRNA on the amino acid. So you get loaded tRNA instead of empty tRNA. What does loaded tRNA do? It carries the load. It ferries the amino acid over to the ribosome in the message. So one point of loading tRNA is so it will be able to carry the amino acid over to the ribosome. It will act as the schlepper. So this implies that the tRNA carries the amino acid or ferries it to where it is supposed to go. Now, calling it a charging or activating enzyme emphasizes that the tRNA amino acid connection is a high energy bond, and that it is the breaking of this bond, to be exact, it's really this one, But the breaking of a connection between a tRNA and an amino acid is what provides the energy to actually drive protein synthesis. So this emphasizes the energy part. Now, calling it an aminoacyl tRNA synthesis emphasizes it's an enzyme with a formal name, and it matches an amino acid with a tRNA. Enzymes are specific, and this emphasizes the specificity of the reaction, that you always match up, or almost always, the right amino acid and the right tRNA. Now, there is one more aspect of tRNA function in protein synthesis that I wish to consider. And this is, but before we do that, let me ask if there are questions about this before we go on. And if not, you want to turn your handout over because we want to talk about the other side. Now, first I want to look at this picture on the right here. Here is a tRNA. This is the 3' end where the amino acid would be. And here's the messenger RNA. So it turns out that UUC and UUU are both codons for the same amino acid. They both code, I in fact forgot to write down what it is. I think it's leucine, but I'm not sure. So, but the point is, it's the same amino acid. It's phenylalanine? That's right. UUU is phenylalanine. So these are both phenylalanine. Therefore, now what is this called? The fact that UUU and UUC code for the same thing. Is this ambiguity, as in this test is ambiguous? Do you always know what UUU and UUC mean?
Yeah.
It's not ambiguous. This just means they're synonyms for UUU, UUC. They're synonyms for phenylalanine. UUU is one, UUC is another. The genetic code is not ambiguous, but it is what is called degenerate, meaning there's more than one word for the same thing. This is not a moral value. This just means they're synonyms. Now, we understand how if we had UUC here in the message, we know what the anticodon would be. As it's written here, the obvious thing is GAA. Now notice I've written it upside down because all pairing is anti-parallel, and I want to emphasize that the codon is written left to right, and the anticodon is anti-parallel. So this position here turns out to be important. This is called position 1 in the codon, position 3 in the codon. From the 5' end of the anticodon, this is position 1 in the anticodon, if you write the anticodon traditionally 5-3. Now, this is what is different. If the codon were UUU, as shown in the bottom case, this means the same amino acid. So we could save on tRNA if we could use the same tRNA to recognize UUU. And it turns out we can. And the reason for that is what is called wobble. Wobble is a way of handling degeneracy efficiently. When you have two nucleotides that are hydrogen bonded or hybridized, they have to be aligned exactly. But you notice that the tRNA and the message are not long. There's only one codon that has to match, one triplet. And the tRNA is bent. As a result of that, the alignment at what is called the wobble position, namely the part in the box, 3' of codon, 1' of anticodon, the wobble position allows what is literally called wobble. The G and the C don't have to be exactly opposite each other in the usual way. They can wiggle a little relative to each other. So if these two can wiggle a little bit according to each other, then base pairing of a slightly unorthodox kind can occur. It can't occur anywhere else. Because of the geometry of the situation, the first two bases in the codon pair only in the orthodox manner, U with A and G with C. But position 3, you can have certain unorthodox combinations. Because the two bases can shift a little relative to each other. So how could G pair with U in the wobble position? The way that works is shown in the box on the left. What is shown on the top there? There are three base pairs shown in the box on the left. The one at the top is a perfectly orthodox CG base pair. The one under it says uracil and adenine, but it's really thymine. But the base pairing is the same. It's a UA or TA base pair. Both of those are perfectly orthodox. When you have an ordinary one, such as here, of G with C, so they've drawn it with the G down here. I'm not going to draw everything in. And the C over here. And the point is that you have a double bond O here and an amino here. And these can form a hydrogen bond. You have an NH at this position and an N here, hydrogen bond. And you have an NH2 here, double bond O, hydrogen bond. So with the traditional GC base pairing, you can form 3. Now, if you replace the C with T in the exact same position, you can't form any hydrogen bonds. But if you rotate the G a little bit relative to the T or the U, that's what's shown in the third picture. So what they've done is to move the G down a little bit. So we just draw it again. Here's the U, has a double bond here instead of an NH2. It has an NH here instead of an N. And it has a double bond O here. But what we've done is to move the G. Normally the G would be such it would be double bond O opposite double bond O, NH against NH, and NH against O. But instead we've moved the G over. So the O on the G, hydrogen bonds to the NH. And the NH on the G, hydrogen bonds to the O. And this is possible because of the wiggle or wobble allowed at the third position of the codon. So as a result, the same tRNA with G here in the wobble position can recognize both UUC and UUU. Now notice what's going on here. The same tRNA recognizes multiple codons, not the other way around. Now, what wobble is allowed? You have a little table at the top here, which is reproduced in your notes in a slightly different form of what is called the wobble rules. What is allowed to pair with what in the wobble position? Now, if you look at this, you notice that what's listed first is the tRNA. If you have C in this position, second line down, or A in this position, third line down, they only pair with their canonical partner. C in the tRNA only pairs with G. A in the tRNA only pairs with U in the message. But go back now, go to the fourth line. If you have G in the tRNA, you can pair with C or with U. And if in the message. And if you go back to the first line, if you were to have U here in the tRNA, it could pair with A, of course, but it could also pair with G. Now, there's a third base here called I. You may have met this already in your problem sets. I is a derivative of A. Normal A has an amino at this position. And it has an N here. So this is normal A. You can see this in the box on the left, second one down. Okay. This is what A looks like. Inosine is what you get, or I, is what you get if this group is oxidized to a double bond O. Now, if that happens, you can't have the double bond here. So this becomes an NH. Now, remember we talked about processing before? We said that you can add a little, take off a little to something. Well, this happens here again. You make the macromolecule, and then you modify it. tRNA is made with A in it, just like any other base. There's T in the template, you put A in the RNA. But in certain positions on the RNA, the A is modified and turned into an I. So some tRNAs have an I in the wobble position of the anticodon. Now, I, it turns out, in the anticodon can pair with U or C or with A. Every other base is one or two, but I pairs with three. And exactly how I can wiggle to do that is shown in the middle box. We won't go through it. You can look at it when you get home. So let's see if everybody's got this. Suppose you have a messenger RNA, and it has the codon for leucine, which is UUA. Well, UUG is also leucine. What tRNA can you use that will read both of these and nothing else? Well, do it. Look up the rules, check with the person next to you, and be sure you're right, and then we'll take a vote. Now, I want to remind you that UU, A, and G are leucine, but UU, C, and U are phenylalanine. So you have, what is the anticodon for the tRNA that matches these? That's what I want to know. So you got a minute to look up the rules, try and figure it out. Quiet in here. Okay. So what base should be here? What base should be here?
A.
No, about this one.
U.
If it's U, how will that help? Not that good at it. UAA. Okay, so if it's U, how do you know that U will pair with both A and G? You have to look up the wobble rules, okay? And the wobble rules tell you that U will pair with both A and G. Okay. Now, could I put I here? I would pair with A, but it wouldn't pair with G. But what's worse, I pairs with you and with C and U. So if I put I here, not only would it recognize UUA, but it would recognize UUC and UUU, and that won't work. So you have to pay attention both to the wobble rules and the code to be sure that the tRNA you have picked will match everything you want it to match and not match anything you don't want it to match. Okay. Now, are there any questions about this or related matters before we go on? Yeah.
So is wobble position synonymous with the number 3 codon position?
Is the wobble position synonymous with the number 3 codon position? Yes. But people talk about the wobble position in messenger RNA and the wobble position in tRNA. So it corresponds to the one position in the anticodon of the tRNA. Now, having said everything that we've said, how many different tRNAs are there minimum? Remember last time we said maybe it's 20-ish, maybe it's 64-ish. It isn't either. It's really 30-ish. How did we get that number? Could it be 64? If there were no wobble, would you need 64 codons? I mean, 64 tRNAs?
Yes.
I hear yes, and I hear no. Why? Somebody said no. Why not? Because the stop codons, remember, there's no tRNA for stop codons, and there are 3 stop codons. So the maximum number of tRNAs we need is 61. Can you think of any reason to need more?
The initiator one?
The initiator methionine. So we need 2 RNAs for methionine. So this is a sort of minus 3 because of the stops. Because of the starts, we have to add plus 1. Okay, now what about wobble? Now, I don't want to go into the exact details, but if you look at each box in your code, you need 2 tRNAs approximately to read each box, with the exception of the stop codons. And so it turns out that the reason you need about 30 is because you need about 2 tRNAs per box. Notice there's no one tRNA that can read all 4 codons in a box. So I'm not going to go into the exact number, but it actually, if there were no wobble, it would be 62. Taking into account wobble, it's approximately 30. I don't want to go into the exact number, but you can look at each box and figure out how many tRNAs. As I said, most of them need 2, but there are a few exceptions. So having said that now, I want to summarize how RNA makes protein. We know that you have to start with the DNA, and you have to make a messenger RNA. And then to read that messenger RNA, you need ribosomes, which contain ribosomal RNA, and you need tRNA. And then you make a protein. Where did the ribosomal RNA and the tRNA come from? Who codes for them? They are coded right off the DNA. So even though we know that there are sections of the DNA we call genes that are read out to make a message that is translated to make a protein, but there are also genes that code for transfer RNA and ribosomal RNA. But when you get a tRNA, it just folds up automatically, first into the clover leaf and then in the L and does its thing. If you get a ribosomal RNA, it meets the appropriate proteins and folds up into a ribosomal subunit. If it's a message, then it meets the ribos and the tRNA, and it gets translated. So if we wanted to make one protein, we'd need a whole set of transfer RNAs. We need at least one ribosome, although we know normally there would be many. And we need a set of tRNAs, we need a ribosome, and we need a message. What does it take? Suppose we change our mind and we want to make a different protein. What do we have to change? Can we use the same ribosomes?
Yeah.
All ribosomes are the same. A ribosome can read anything. What about transfer RNA? Same transfer RNAs can be used to make anything. What we have to change is the messenger RNA. Once the whole system is set up, the ribosomes, the transfer RNA, and additional proteins constitute the hardware, the machine, the assembly line. But the information to run the assembly line, what exactly we're going to turn out, the software, depends on the messenger RNA. Now, we haven't emphasized this before, but messenger RNA has a relatively short half-life in bacteria. In prokaryotes, it's continually made, used many times, but not forever, degraded, and new ones are made. So the bacterium is always making new messages that are suitable for the moment to make the proteins it needs right now. On the other hand, ribosomal RNA and transfer RNA are long-lived. Like proteins, they are used over and over and over and over again until they wear out. And they have relatively long half-lives. Now, we have been assuming all along that all of this always works. Nobody ever makes mistakes. This is how it is. But I want to consider now, for the last part of the class, what happens if you make mistakes. Suppose the ribosome in the tea is tootling along, and something goes wrong, and we put in the long amino acid. There's a long song and dance in your notes about what we just said, but you can read it later. So suppose the ribosome makes a mistake, and you put in the wrong amino acid. How bad is this? Can you make good protein next time? We assume the ribosome made an oops. It was a mistake. When the next ribosome comes along, reads the same message, the message is fine, the ribosome is fine. That was just an accident. Next protein molecule should be fine. So a mistake in protein synthesis is not that serious as long as it doesn't happen too often. You have a little bad protein, but now you can make good ones. You had good ones before, you have good ones after. The same thing applies to making ribosomal RNA and transfer RNA. But now suppose you make a mistake in transcription and there's a mistake in the message. Is that better or worse? Why is it worse? Because each message now gets read by many ribosomes to make 50 or 100 or maybe 1,000 molecules of protein before that message is degraded and new message is made. So all the protein molecules made using this message are going to be wrong. So you're going to have, this is more serious, you're going to have more bad molecules of protein. But can you ever make good protein again? No problem, because the DNA is still okay. So next time you make new message, the new message will be fine, the new protein will be fine, and as long as this doesn't happen too often, we're okay. What if you make a mistake in DNA replication, or the DNA gets damaged? So one wrong base gets put in, say A opposite C instead of G. Are we up the creek here? Turns out we have enzymes, and so do bacteria, for repair. Remember, DNA is double-stranded. So this DNA with a mistake can actually be removed, and the other strand can be used as template, and we can make a repair. So is there is a possibility now of repair. So we have here potential for trouble, but it could get fixed. But what if it doesn't get fixed and we get DNA replication? Then the top strand is template for a normal partner, but the bottom strand now has a mistake, so the appropriate complement to the mistake is going to get put in. Now, what about the cell that gets this one? Can it ever make good protein again? It is up the creek. So this now, people say the mutation is fixed. At this stage of one strand, the mutation isn't fixed yet. Now, you understand what fixed means here? It doesn't mean repaired. It means permanently locked in. So the mutation's not permanently locked in when it's only in one strand. But once both strands are mutated, you've lost the original information, and the mutation is said to be fixed in place. Now, turns out, I've been using the term mutation. When you change the RNA or the protein, that's called a mistake in RNA synthesis or a mistake in protein synthesis. But when you change the DNA because of a mistake, that has a special name. That's called a mutation. Only a change in DNA is called a mutation because only that change is inherited. Because this altered DNA now will make copies of itself and be passed down generation after generation. So this is called a mutation. Now, why do we have mutations? This is a good news, bad news sort of situation. Mutations are actually the source of all variation in the genetic information. If we didn't have any variation, there'd be nothing for selection to act on. There would be no evolution. We would never have gotten here. There would be blobs of gulp at best. So mutations are absolutely necessary in order to have evolution or change over time. But if there's too many mutations, you get into deep trouble because mutations usually cause trouble. Mutations cause inherited diseases like Tay-Sachs disease, cystic fibrosis, Huntington's disease. So there's a balance. The mutation rate is very, very low in order to provide enough variation, but for selection. But it's kept very low so that most organisms don't have serious defects, at least not two copies of it. Now, mutation has another positive effect. Remember I said that my DNA is different from that of anybody else, living person in the world? The reason for that is mutation. Mutation in parts of the DNA that don't code for anything. Mutations that are said to be neutral and that make no difference. Those mutations occur, too bad, they get passed on, who cares? That's been going on for millions of years, and as a result, the DNA of each person in the world is different in the DNA of everybody else. Now, this DNA has turned out, this variation, to be the most of use to human society because this is the basis of all forensics and identifications. It's all based on junk. What we know about the Human Genome Project turns out the most useful part is the part that doesn't do anything. That's the most practically useful part. Now, there is another use of mutations, which is it allows you, like with RNAi, to knock out one gene at a time and see what happens. And it allows you to discover function. Now, what happens in real life is that scientists make mutations or add drugs or use RNAi and they figure out how something works. The way we do it here is we generally explain to you how it works and then we send you home with the problem set which has all those mutations in it. And that's what we're going to do. But in order to do that, there are one or two terms you need to understand. So I'm going to say that even though it takes another minute or two so you can do all the problems. And then next time we will give a real example of how you use mutations. Now, when you make changes in the DNA, if you have some sequence, and I'm just going to write the sense strand, say like this. You can change one base to another, like so. That's called a substitution. Now, that can change the properties of the organism, or it may not, because the code is degenerate and for many other reasons. And so you have to distinguish between the state of the DNA, which is called the genotype, and the properties of the organism, which are called the phenotype. If the genotype is changed or mutant, the phenotype can still be normal, or what people call wild type, because this protein, even with a change, this sense strand may produce message that produces protein that works just as well. In which case, no change in properties, no change in phenotype. Now, there's another kind of mutation which is very important that we should mention, where instead of changing a base, you add or lose one. You take one out. That's called a deletion. If you put in an extra one, not surprisingly, it's called an insertion. Now, if you put in or take out multiples of three, nothing much happens. But if you put in multiples of one or two, or take them out, then you mess everything up. Because remember that you read starting from the first AUG in threes. So if you take out or put in a base, you change the so-called reading frame. Consider the following sentence, which all has three-letter words. The fat cat ate the rat. Well, if I change it to the fat cat, fat cat ate the hat, or the fat cat ate the bat, I haven't really messed it up very much. It's a little sillier, but... But what if I take out the second letter? Then I'll read it in threes from the beginning, and it will become complete and utter garbage. And that's called a frame shift. And there's one other piece of terminology, but I think of nonsense versus missense versus nonsense, but I think that will become obvious from doing the problems. So I'm going to stop here, and next time we will talk about how you regulate protein synthesis. Thank you.